Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk about the three key political leaders in the Stalinist takeover of Eastern Europe: Walter Ulbricht, Matthias Rakosi, and Boleslav Bierut, the three communist leaders of East Germany, of Hungary, and of Poland, respectively. And it's important to look at these three characters because so much, when we discuss the fate of Eastern Europe after the end of the Second World War, focuses on the figure of Stalin himself. And it's to suggest that, A, the leaders of these countries lacked their own sense of agency, which isn't true at all. They were quite capable, within certain parameters, of making decisions for themselves. And secondly, it focuses on, it puts too much emphasis on Stalin being the sole driver of events after 1945, to his death in 1953. Obviously, he has a huge significance. But he doesn't wind up dealing with completely pliant client states. These are countries that have had Soviet communism imposed upon them, but they come with their own challenges, their own diplomatic ups and downs as well. So let's examine them today, starting with Walter Ulbricht. And today we're looking at Anne Applebaum's history of the period 1945 to 1953, Iron Curtain, the crushing of Eastern Europe. Anne Applebaum previously wrote a history of the Gulags entitled Gulag. Her more recent book on the Soviet famines has attracted controversy. Is a highly, highly contentious area of study, and it's something hopefully we'll look at in the near future. We've hit upon the famines a number of times in the past, but it's a very volatile area of debate. Anyway, moving swiftly on. So, Anne Applebaum writes, "Once their names appeared on red banners, their portraits were carried in parades. No government office was complete without their photographs hanging on the wall. No national celebration could be held without them. They inspired awe and fear. Even their closest friends spoke guardedly when they entered the room. Yet in none of their respective countries are the men, sometimes known as the Little Stalins, Walter Ulbricht of East Germany, Boleslav Bierut of Poland, and Matthias Rakosi of Hungary, now admired at all. Even at the height of their powers, none of them ever held total power. The cults created around them were merely shadow versions of the cult created around Stalin himself. His comrades frequently hailed Stalin as the great genius, the continuer of Lenin's immortal cause, something which was never quite said about Stalin's Eastern European imitators, I beg your pardon. At the same time, no account of post-war Eastern Europe can be complete without a brief examination of the men whose names and faces were once ubiquitous in the streets of their respective countries." I think it's so important to reclaim the names of these men for the kind of the broader historical record, away from the kind of the monolithic shadow of Stalin, because as it says here, they were ubiquitous figures, the heads of their own regimes, and they also saw a long period of contrasting and developing relations with the Soviet Union, of which not all were completely harmonious. Each country had its own issues to resolve. So let's look at, firstly, the background of Walter Ulbricht, where he came from and how he emerged. He was the son of a poor tailor in Germany, and he left school early to become a cabinet maker and joined the Young Workers' Educational Association, a kind of a socialist club that was fixated on clean living and temperance, and the kinds of attitudes and values that held working class communities together, and saw that there was should be time for earnest discussion of the works of Marx and social events. These kinds of things that had existed in European countries since probably the 1890s. They sang Marxist songs whilst hiking, and it was a part of the kind of the wider phenomenon of the German youth movement that existed from the late 19th century onwards. He was drafted into the army in 1915, but deserted in 1918. He hated military life, and he was part of a kind of a generation of deserters, as it was clear increasingly that the war was unwinnable. And he witnessed in 1918 the revolution that unseated the Kaiser. He was in Leipzig at the time and saw a workers' uprising there and a very, very brief socialist republic. And at that point, he began to earnestly read Marx. He had grown up on the kind of the periphery of Marxist discourse in sort of youth socialist groups. But now he embraced Marx and saw really in Marx's kind of dialectics of class struggle a simple explanation to the world that really all history was the history of class struggle, and that the ruling classes would do what they could do to suppress the people and suppress the workers as much as they possibly could do. So, during the Weimar years, Ulbricht rose very quickly through the ranks of the German Communist Party and became a sort of a very rigorous and active party organiser, and joined the Central Committee of the party in 1923. Ulbricht was an avowed Leninist. He believed in this idea of a highly centralised party, this kind of contradictory notion that Lenin comes up with, of democratic centralism. And he made his first visit to Moscow in 1924-25, where he joined the Lenin School, which is the really kind of the cradle of Comintern. And he returned back to Germany in 1926, where he became assistant to Ernst Thälmann, party chief, who eventually would suffer the fate of the Nazi camps. And he became a member of the Parliament of Saxony and then a member of the Reichstag from 1928-33, and became the chairman of the Communist Party in Berlin and Brandenburg from 1929 onwards. So he would have been very, very high on the kind of the Nazi to-do list during the late 1920s, early 1930s. After 1928, Ulbricht is an avowed Stalinist within the KPD, and he contributes to one of the great catastrophes of Weimar democracy. The Red Fighting Leagues and the other communist militias that fought it out with the Nazis on the streets were to some extent concerned with the rise of radical nationalism and fascism in Germany, but were more fixated, and Ulbricht was more fixated because this is one of Stalin's main hobby horses, on the social democrats themselves, the social fascists as they were referred to. There was little chance of a popular front against fascism emerging in Germany, and the reason for that is because Stalin forbade it. He saw moderate social democrats as being far more dangerous than the Nazis. He thought the Nazis were a strange temporary aberration and a kind of a tool of capitalism to attack the working class. But the social democrats, in the eyes of the Stalinists, were much, much worse, because these were the types of accommodationists, those who would make their peace with capitalism, not seek to overthrow it, and hope for some minor concessions for the working class. This was the KPD and the Stalinist view, and thus keep the parties of capitalism, or the hegemonic forces of capitalism, in power by kind of taking any sort of revolutionary energy out of the working classes by gradually improving their living standards, and so. By dividing the left, by making sure that there was little chance of either the communists or the SPD unifying, seeing eye to eye, and standing up, despite their differences, to Nazism, the Nazis were, as a kind of a significant minority, but a minority nonetheless, a minority party nonetheless, able to divide and rule. When Talman was thrown in jail in 1933, Ulbricht made himself scarce and lived in Prague between 1933 and 1937. But one of his key roles was as a Stalinist in Spain. Ulbricht went to Spain and identified German members of the international brigades who were not sufficiently Stalinist, and ensured that they were at certain points taken out and shot. He made sure that within the German battalions of the international brigades, that Stalinism was in the ascendancy. And so Spain, in many ways, was a kind of a great proving ground to show that the Ulbricht, as a rising star in Stalin's eyes, had what Stalin would have viewed as the kind of the toughness, the kind of the brutalness that revolution is needed in order to see revolutionary ideas triumph. He tried to persuade Willy Münzberg, the founder of the KPD, to go to the Soviet Union in 1936, saying ominously that the Soviet Union would, in inverted commas, take care of him. Willy Münzberg, reading between the lines, knew fully what this implied, and wisely turned down Ulbricht. He later fled to Paris, but was interned during the war by the Daladier government, and died in mysterious circumstances, possibly at the hands of the French Communist Party, in a forest in France. Ulbricht, again, serves this role as kind of enforcer for Stalin, not really doing much of the dirty work himself, but ensuring that Stalin's reach pervaded Europe. And it was through these sorts of networks and these kinds of loyalties that Stalinism was able to pervade European Communist Party.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
And Applebaum writes again. Even after the signing of the Hitler-Stalin Pact in 1939, he stuck to his support for Stalin. This moment provoked a great crisis among German communists, most of whom were passionate and genuine anti-Nazis. Ulbricht was one of the few who did not waver. Even after Stalin sent several hundred German communists back to Hitler's concentration camps at Hitler's request, Ulbricht continued to agitate against primitive anti-fascism, meaning anti-fascism which did not allow for nuances such as pacts with fascists. Perhaps it was then that he won the Soviet dictator's trust. And that, again, I would perhaps agree with Anne Applebaum there, that those who managed to stay the course of party loyalty following the shock of the Nazi-Soviet pact, which disillusioned countless fellow travellers in the West and led to the abandonment of Communist Party membership across Europe, those that managed to stay the course were certainly, in Stalin's eyes, very special individuals indeed. There was something of the kind of the wooden bureaucrat about Ulbricht, and again, this would perhaps have appealed to Stalin, who was very suspicious of those with an air for showmanship or flamboyance, the likes of Trotsky, or at the end of the Second World War, Zhukov, and his collection of medals, which Stalin felt very resentful about. However, whatever charisma he lacked, when he came to power, both in the Communist Party and then as head of state of the new East German state, it was known implicitly that he was Stalin's choice, and therefore he was the recipient of patronage, and this patronage gave Ulbricht everything he needed. He was a loyal servant who repaid the faith that Stalin had placed in him, and in one key example, was willing to tolerate any excesses of the Red Army in Germany, any crimes of the Red Army in Germany, and refused to discuss the issue of Red Army rapes of German women. One of his colleagues wrote, "Ulbricht's workload amazed even his enemies. We kept asking ourselves, how can Ulbricht keep up 12 or 14, sometimes 16 hours a day?" His party colleagues began to realise, however, that the problem here was that he was simply receiving endless diktats from Moscow, and this immense workload was him simply deciding how those diktats would be interpreted. So it is, you know, a heavy workload, perhaps not necessarily a challenging one. And it was a case in some ways of deciding who would suffer most as a result of Stalin's whims. So let's talk about Bayreuth. In comparison to Ulbricht, Bayreuth is a very different figure. Described by Anne Applebaum as a far shadier character. She writes, "He probably came from eastern Poland, a region which was part of the Russian Empire until 1917, and it seems he went to a Russian language school. Like Stalin's parents, Bayrat's parents hoped he would be a priest. But after he participated in the strikes which broke out across the Russian Empire in 1905, he was expelled from school and had to work. Some sources think he might have joined the Freemasons, but others disagree. All do agree that he joined the party very early on and that he attended the Comintern's International Lenin School in Moscow in the 1920s. So once again, Comintern features in this story very heavily as a kind of a training school for party apparatchiks. And the other thing that's really interesting about Boleslav Bayrat's origins is that he emerges, as so many key figures in the history of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe do, from the kind of the chaos of the breakup of one of the three great empires, Habsburg, Romanov, and Hohenzollern, the German. So Bayrat, like Ulbricht, a kind of a non-entity in Germany for the most part, well, a non-entity in Poland, just as Ulbricht was in Germany, very loosely known, vaguely known at all. His power comes from not being politically known or valued in his home country, but being politically valued by Comintern. So he travelled round Europe in the 1930s on the Soviet Communist Party's behalf in Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Bulgaria. During the war, very little is known about Bayrat. He seems to vanish into the Soviet Union, leaving behind a wife and child. And he seems to also have been capable of working for the Nazi administration in Minsk when the city is occupied. It was probable, though it's not entirely proven, that he was a Soviet agent at the time. But it's entirely possible that he saw himself as a survivor making do. He may well have worked for the Gestapo, as has been suggested by some. That's never been kind of proven. Stalin often admired men who were capable of kind of ruthless cynicism, and saw it as a kind of a kind of almost a benefit, and it was always a good means of blackmailing. But he was always quick to adopt whatever party line was fashionable, particularly the idea that one should not collaborate, or Polish communists should not collaborate with anti-communist Polish partisans in a united front against the Nazis during the war. This was something that Stalin rejected, particularly because after Stalingrad, the fate of Germany, but also the fate of Poland, was written, and Stalin knew it, and Stalin knew that strengthening anti-communist forces before the Red Army marched into Poland would only weaken his hand later on. So Matthias Rakosi, the third of the kind of the triumvirate of little Stalins, who was far more kind of flamboyant character, the son of a Jewish merchant, and well educated. He was born into a Hungarian speaking part of what would now be Serbia, and was the fourth child in a family of 12. So his father, who had gone bankrupt when he was 6 years old, moved the family from kind of relatively affluent to kind of relatively modest circumstances. And this seems to have kind of drawn him towards revolutionary politics as he grew through his teenage years. He was a kind of a very difficult student in school, very rebellious. It's interesting, you can see a lot of this in Stalin as well. And in 1918, he helped found the Hungarian Communist Party. He'd been both a political prisoner at this point and also served in the army. In 1919, he was one of the leaders of the Belokonz, Hungarian Soviet Republic, which was eventually crushed by Romania. In this three-month period, he managed to become the commander-in-chief of the Red Guard, commissar for production, and deputy commissioner for commerce. And when the Hungarian Soviet Republic collapsed, he made his way via Austria, via an Austrian prison, to Moscow, as did Belokon, where in 1921 he briefly met Lenin. And this would be transformed into a kind of like a monomyth about Matthias Rakosi, which would be that he was a kind of like one of Lenin's chosen. He was a friend and collaborator, and kind of one of the one of the people who was on par with Lenin, which is a total fantasy. Another Comintern activist, and during the 1920s and 30s, and he was allowed to travel to the Soviet Union in 1940, when, as a result of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, Admiral Horthy's Hungary allowed political prisoners or allowed emigration from Hungary to the Soviet Union, particularly the transmission of imprisoned communists. And Applebaum writes, upon arrival, he received a hero's welcome and even stood beside Stalin during the year's celebration on the Great October Revolution. He quickly became one of the leaders of Kossuth Radio, Kossuth being one of the liberal nationalist revolutionaries of 1848 in Hungary, which was already broadcasting Soviet propaganda into Hungary, and resumed his close ties with the Comintern leaders. Thoroughly at home in the USSR, he even managed to marry a Soviet prosecutor, a Yakut woman who was first husband had been a Red Army officer. Rakosi's career as Hungary's little Stalin followed that of his fellow dictators in another respect. Rakosi reckoned early on the only way to get ahead and to stay on top was to slavishly follow the edicts of Stalin. Throughout the post-war period, the Hungarian Communist Party made no important decisions without Soviet approval, as Rakosi readily admitted. In his memoirs, he wrote frankly, for example, that Stalin asked him to stay out of negotiations which formed the first post-war government in 1945, on the grounds that Rakosi was too closely associated with the 1919 government. In other words, he was too communist, and also because he was Jewish, a fact which might be used against him by his political opponents. Rakosi did not object on either count. So there you have these three important figures, and we'll be returning to them fairly shortly, and looking at how the three of them began to shape the new post-war order in Eastern Europe after 1945. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.